This is Audible.
All That Glitters, a Rain Stockton Dog Mystery. Written by Donna Ball. Narrated by Donna Postel. There are people, I know, who say dogs don't understand Christmas. These people clearly have never had dogs. These same people say that dogs have little, if any, long-term memory, and no ability to conceptualize or categorize events. I would very much like those people to explain to me how a field champion golden retriever can sit by his handler's side and watch four different birds be shot down and fall in four different places in a marsh 600 yards away, and then, on command, go directly to each bird and return it to the handler in the precise order that it fell. And then they can explain why my golden retriever, upon seeing a certain green felt wreath wrapped in plaid ribbon come out of its box for the first time every year, automatically sits and starts licking his chops in anticipation. The dog bone wreath is a Christmas tradition that has gone on as long as I have owned dogs. Every year on December 15th, the wreath comes out and is decorated with colorful frosted bone-shaped dog biscuits and hung in a prominent place in the training room. Each day until Christmas, the dogs get a bone from the wreath, like a doggy advent calendar. Since the wreath is only up 10 days a year, and since a year is a really, really long time for a dog, you'd think they would forget in between Christmases. But they never do. Dogs might not understand the concept of Christmas, but they have never misunderstood the concept of treats. This year, my young friend Melanie, age 10 going on 30, was helping me decorate the kennel for the Dog Day's annual Christmas party. Her puppy, Pepper, was in the back having a shampoo and blowout for the big event, and the rest of the dogs were out in the play yard with one of the kennel staff. But Cisco refused to be distracted from the excitement he could literally smell on the air. He was Cisco, after all, and tracking was his specialty. Melanie laughed when the dog bone wreath went up on its hook, and Cisco, with the instincts of a born chowhound, looked up from the cardboard wrapping paper tube he was chewing, spotted the wreath without hesitation, galloped across the room, and skidded to a perfect sit beneath it. Even I couldn't prevent a grin and a respectful round of applause.
"Can he have a biscuit now, Rain?" Melanie asked. "This is day one, right? I think he should have a biscuit now."
It had taken the two of us half an hour to tie the dozens of dog biscuits to the wreath with decorative plaid bows, and we had enjoyed the display for less than a minute, but what kind of Scrooge would I be to say no? I untied a treat and gave Melanie the privilege of dispensing it. "Come on," I said, picking up the box of Christmas ornaments. "Everyone is going to be here at 2, and we've got to finish decorating the dog tree. Grab that box of Christmas stockings, too, will you?" Melanie plopped her Santa's helper elf hat back atop her unruly dark curls, gave me a snappy salute, and picked up the box of miniature felt stockings that we would be stuffing with dog biscuits as party favors. Cisco made a quick detour to grab his half-chewed cardboard wrapping paper tube and dashed after us. In a small town like our Smoky Mountain community of Hansonville, North Carolina, December is filled with parties, tree lightings, pageants, and concerts. I'm happy to say that the Dog Day's Christmas party is among the most prestigious of all the community events, at least with the dog crowd. It had started out as a way for my business partner Maud and me to thank our clients for their patronage throughout the year, but had grown to include just about everyone in town with a dog. We had obedience and agility demonstrations, dog games and human games, cookies, cupcakes, and punch for the humans, and dog biscuits and fresh water for the canines. Everyone brought a wrapped dog toy for the gift exchange, and an item from the local shelter's wish list, which we collected in a big basket by the door and delivered to the shelter after the party. We opened up the play yard and let the dogs run and jump and tumble the way God intended, and as a happy bonus, we usually signed up a handful of new clients for obedience, grooming, or boarding at the end of the day. It really was my favorite party of the year. I kept the training room comfortably cool for the dogs, but as we left it for the gaily decorated entry foyer, a rush of warm air, holiday music, and the scent of a very expensive cinnamon and clove kennel deodorizer greeted us. Dog bone studded garland wrapped in twinkling lights wreathed the room, and a fragrant spruce tree, also twinkling with lights,
sat on an elevated table in a corner of the room. Where dogs are involved, it's never a good idea to put the Christmas tree on the floor. Two long folding tables, decorated with plastic red and white paw print tablecloths, were laden with platters of dog biscuits and human cookies, all clearly labeled to avoid misunderstanding. Gingerbread cookies shaped like dog biscuits are a great addition to any dog-themed Christmas party, except when the dog biscuits are also decorated to look like gingerbread men. There was a basket of festive holiday bandanas for our canine guests and a bowl of fruit punch for our human guests, and the centerpiece was a miniature plastic Christmas tree decorated with photographs of all our obedient school graduates for the year. After the party, the proud parents would take their pup's picture home as a memento. I held the door open with my hip for Cisco, who looked stylish in his own bright green Santa's Helper bandana. Naturally, he was stopped short when the two ends of the long cardboard tube he carried in his mouth wouldn't fit through the door, but he solved the problem by neatly snapping the tube in two with his teeth, picking up both pieces, and prancing through the door with his golden tail waving proudly. "Hey, look at all this cool dog stuff," Melanie said as I sat the ornament box on the floor. She held up a box of silver paw print ornaments and giggled when she found a golden retriever with a pair of wings and a halo. "Is this Cisco?" "Hardly." I relieved Cisco of the cardboard tube and stuffed it in the trash. Before I could turn around, he had snatched a cookie from the tray on the table, swallowed it, and was sitting innocently by Melanie's side with nothing but a few multicolored sugar sprinkles on his muzzle to testify to his crime. It's pointless to correct a dog for his misbehavior after he's consumed the evidence, particularly when there aren't even any witnesses to the crime. So all I could do was scowl meaningfully at Cisco and push the cookie tray away from the edge of the table. "Is there one with horns and a pointy tail?"
"Cisco is a good dog," Melanie corrected me pompously, giving Cisco a scratch behind the ears before stretching to hang the golden retriever Angel on the tree. "You just don't appreciate him. Right, Cisco?"
It was Christmas, and I was in a good mood, so I did not remind Melanie that this morning alone, Cisco had overturned the Christmas tree while dashing to the door to greet her when she arrived, left muddy paw prints on her dad's cashmere coat, jumped on the kitchen counter and consumed half a bowl of frosting before I could stop him, and hopelessly shredded the brand new roll of wrapping paper that used to be on the cardboard tube he had just finished mangling. Granted, that last one was my fault. I should have been watching him. "I appreciate him plenty," I told Melanie, "but I can appreciate him just as much while he's having a nice time out in the kennel." Cisco gave a little woof of protest and dug into the ornament box, coming up with a hand-knitted sheep given to me by my aunt. Melanie laughed.
"See?" she said. "He's trying to help. What would you do without him?" I gently pried the delicate work of art out of his mouth, blotted off the saliva, and hung it on the tree next to a matching knitted collie, well out of his reach.
Cisco dived into the box to see what else he could find, and naturally turned the box over. He backed up quickly, as all the ornaments spilled out around his feet, looking up at me in such consternation that I had to grin. "Life would definitely be a lot less interesting," I admitted, scooping the spilled ornaments back into the box before they were crushed by clumsy paws. "But, you know, if it had been up to me, I never would have gotten him." Melanie looked surprised.
"Really? You didn't want Cisco?"
I felt a ridiculous urge to cover Cisco's ears when she said that. But in typical golden retriever fashion, he had already lost interest in the Christmas tree and was once again eyeing the buffet table. I gave him a warning, and he quickly returned his attention to me, tail waving innocently. "I didn't know he was Cisco then," I explained to Melanie. "I just didn't think I was ready for a puppy."
"Wow," she said, carefully hanging a row of border collies in tartan plaid bows around the circumference of the tree. "What if you hadn't gotten Cisco? It would be just like that old black-and-white movie Dad made me watch the other night."
For a moment I was baffled, and then I said, "It's a Wonderful Life?"
Melanie nodded enthusiastically. "Just think how many people he's rescued," Melanie said, "tracking them down out there in the wilderness,
And the bad guys he's put in jail. And what about all the old people he visits in the nursing home and kids in the hospital?
Cisco knows what a great dog he is, I said, rescuing a bone-shaped ornament from Cisco's mouth and giving him a little nudge with my knee. He doesn't need a press agent.
How many lives do you think he's saved anyway?
When Cisco was relaxing at home, as now, it might be hard to convince a stranger that he was a valuable working dog. But when Melanie put it like that, I felt a surge of pride and affection that momentarily overcame my impulse to put Cisco in a permanent downstay.
A lot, I admitted. More than 10?
Sure.
More than 20?
I paused to give my guy a scratch under the chin, smiling at him. He reciprocated with a happy swipe of his tongue aimed at my face.
Probably, I agreed. And I thought that, in some ways, the most important life he had saved was my own.
Of course, Melanie observed confidently. That's nothing to what my Pepper is going to do when she grows up. I reached for another ornament.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. We're going to join the FBI and chase down terrorists and spies all over the world. Istanbul, Dubai, Hong Kong, Milan, Paris?
The FBI can only chase down terrorists and spies on U.S. soil, I pointed out, suppressing a grin. Her recitation of exotic locales was more suggestive of a series of fashion shows than an international terrorism ring, but I supposed anything was possible.
Plenty of time for that to change before we join the force, she assured me airily. The point is, we're going to be real crime-solving heroes, just like you and Cisco.
Of course, it was flattering to be thought of as a hero by anyone, but I made a face, keeping a wary eye on my dog as he strolled casually toward the buffet table once again. There have been a lot of days when hero is not the first word I thought of to describe Cisco. Then sharply, Cisco, here! Cisco turned guiltily and came back to me, breaking into a heart-melting grin halfway across the room. But I refused to be melted. Go to your place, I told him sternly, pointing to a yellow mat by the door. His tail dropped a few inches at the words, and he looked over his shoulder toward the mat. Then he spotted the chew bone he had left there and bounded over to it happily, plopping down on the mat and taking up his bone.
Say, is this Cisco's baby picture?
Melanie held up a Christmas ornament with a photograph of a golden retriever puppy in a red jingle bell collar sitting on Santa's knee. I couldn't prevent a sentimental smile as I reached for it.
Yes, it is, I said. He was 8 weeks old. I'd only had Cisco for a few minutes when this was taken. And right after that,
I stretched as high as I could, placing the ornament on a safe, sturdy branch.
Cisco solved his first crime.
Really? Her eyes lit with the avid interest of someone who watched far too many cop shows on television, in my opinion.
Who'd he nab? A kidnapper? Gangbanger? A cold-blooded serial killer? Maybe he busted up a whole drug cartel.
The corners of my lips twitched as I glanced across the room at Cisco, who held the bone between his two front paws and was contentedly munching away. Much bigger than that, I assured her. As a matter of fact, I added, and I felt a twinkle come into my eyes as I pulled out another handful of ornaments and looked back at her. It's really kind of an interesting story. It had not been a good year for me, nor for the majority of the county. The textile plant that had provided jobs for almost half of the families in the county had closed down, which drastically affected the economy of our small, isolated mountain town. Shops and businesses were starting to cut back their hours, which is never a good sign. And according to Aunt Mart, who was in charge of just about every charitable organization in town, donations to the charity drive were down, while requests for charity had never been higher. According to Uncle Roe, who was married to Aunt Mart, and who also happened to be the sheriff of Hanover County, crime was also up. That surprised no one but Aunt Mart, who liked to see the best in everyone. I probably should have been more concerned about the unemployment rate, the rising crime, and the general state of need surrounding me. But as I said, I had not had a good year either. This would be my first Christmas without my father, who had died of a stroke earlier that year. I was recently separated, for the second time, from the man to whom I had been married for 10 years, and who had been my best friend since high school. I was still at that stage where I kept expecting to hear his footsteps in the hallway, and I picked up the phone to call him several times a day, before I remembered we didn't do that anymore. That sucked. And perhaps most devastatingly, my golden retriever Cassidy had died at age 13 that summer. She was the one who taught me everything I know about dogs. She was the first certified search and rescue dog in Hanover County, and her find rate was 98%. She made me look like a superstar. She had more awards than a Nobel laureate and more letters after her name than an Oxford professor. But at the end of the day, she was the one who curled up on the sofa beside me and shared the popcorn on movie night, who was waiting at the door every time I picked up my car keys, who laid her head upon my knee when I was sad, and who danced with excitement when I was happy. She made me who I was. Now she was gone, and I was alone. And, almost as though to add insult to injury, it now appeared as though I would lose my job, too. I stared in disbelief at the letter that had arrived in the morning mail. Due to cutbacks in federal funding, we have been forced to downsize. I had worked for the Forest Service here in the Smoky Mountains since college. It was all I'd ever wanted to do. I wasn't sure I really even knew how to do anything else. From my supervisor, Rick, who had graduated 2 years ahead of me in high school, was a scrawled note on the bottom of the official letter. "Rain, call me. We'll work something out." Great. The man had graduated 96th out of a class of 102, and now I was depending on him to work something out. Terrific. Merry Christmas to me, I muttered. I flung my booted feet atop the kitchen table and dropped my head back onto the chair, and there was absolutely no one to tell me not to do it. That made me even more depressed. When the phone rang, I almost didn't answer it. Given the way my luck was running, it had to be more bad news. I answered it curtly. "Rain Stockton."
"Hey, Rain," said the chirpy voice on the other end of the line. "This is Rose down at dispatch. We've got a call about an abandoned dog out on Mockingbird Place, and your uncle wanted to know, wouldn't you mind going out there to check it out? The boys are just covered up with work down here, and the sheriff said to be sure and tell you he'd really appreciate it. Our small county couldn't afford an animal control officer. So when a complaint about a dog came in, it was usually through the sheriff's office. Unless it was a dog bite case, most of those calls were referred to the Humane Society. And since I had been president of the Humane Society for the past 4 years, that meant me. With a long-suffering sigh, I copied down the address, pulled on my coat, and went out into the cold to Mockingbird Place. The address led me to a row of small square houses a few blocks from the center of town. 50 years ago, they had probably been perfectly respectable middle-income homes. Now they were a couple of notches below that. Most of them had the not-quite-neglected look of rental property, with shabby lawns and worn shingles. I pulled into the short dirt driveway of a pale-yellow clapboard house with a mud-stained cement block foundation, and I saw the dog immediately. A sable and white collie of about a year old sat imperiously atop a doghouse inside a 10-by-10 chain-link enclosure. At least, I thought it was a collie. Her coat was so muddied and matted with neglect that it was difficult to tell. She didn't bark when I got out of the car. She didn't jump down and rush the fence to greet me. She just sat atop the doghouse with all the composure of a royal princess and watched as I approached. "Well, hello there, Your Majesty," I said softly, putting my hand on the latch of the gate to the dog's enclosure. "Do you mind if I come in?" The screen door of the house next door slammed, and a woman came down the steps, hugging a pink cardigan to her. "Hello," she called. "Hello, are you here about the dog?" I admitted that I was, and she introduced herself. "I hated to call," she said, "but the family left last week. She said the propane tank was dry and they didn't have any heat. A sweet young thing with 3 children under school age. Her husband left last month, the no-account so-and-so, and she's been doing the best she can since then, I guess. She and the children went to her sister's, but she couldn't take the dog, so I've been feeding it and making sure it had water, but the bag of food she left is almost gone, and it's supposed to get down in the teens tonight. She didn't leave me a way to call, and I just hate to see the poor thing freeze to death. It's a sweet dog. I assured her that she had done the right thing and entered the pen with a slice of hot dog in one hand and a slip leash in the other. The collie didn't fuss as I dropped the leash over her head, and she nibbled on the hot dog I offered her with a delicacy that suggested she was simply being polite. "We'll take her to the vet to make sure she's up on her shots," I told the neighbor, "and board her until the owner claims her. But if she isn't claimed in 5 days, we put her up for adoption. I'll leave you one of my cards, and slip another one under the front door so the owner can call when she comes back." The neighbor took my card, but shook her head sadly, hugging the pink sweater closer to her. "She won't come back. And even if she does, she won't call you. She can barely take care of those children, much less a dog." I suspected she was right, but it wasn't my job to say so. The collie hopped into the back of my SUV and walked nicely into the wire crate I had prepared for her. I was just locking her in when I heard the sound of a big truck coming around the bend. It was a propane tanker, and to my surprise, it pulled into the driveway beside my car. The driver got out and came around to me. "Miss Chambliss?" "No," I said, shaking my head. "I'm just here to..." "She's not here," the neighbor said, coming over to us. The engine of the propane truck rumbled in the background, and she raised her voice to be heard. "It got too cold when they ran out of gas."
"Well, this ought to help."
He went around the side of the truck and started uncoiling the filler hose.
"We got an order to fill the tank this morning, along with $300 in cash to cover it. Somebody left it in the drop box last night, along with this note."
He reached in the pocket of his flannel shirt and pulled out a torn half sheet of white paper. On it was scrawled, "From your secret Santa." I lifted an eyebrow and smiled at the neighbor. "Well, that's good news. I'll make sure the dog is taken care of until she gets back, but be sure to tell her to call."
"She won't call,"
the woman assured me, puzzling over the paper the driver showed her.
"She might come back, but she won't call."
I wanted to leave on a positive note, but I knew she was probably right.
"Well, if you want my opinion," announced my friend Maud a couple of days later,
"that little collie has already found a good home." I had known Maud for most of my life, and she was, in many ways, as much of a mother to me as my own mother had been. When she spoke, I usually listened, in part because she had a clipped British accent that made every word she spoke sound more important than it was, and in part because she had proven to be right about most things over the years, but not about this. "I'm not looking for a dog," I told her firmly. "Besides, that collie is going to be easy to place. Look how nicely she cleaned up. Definitely a purebred. If I can get her picture in the paper this weekend, we'll have a dozen calls before Christmas." Maud worked with me on the Humane Society, and I had brought her out to the barn to have a look at the collie. I had fixed up one of the stalls in the barn for the dog, although, of course, I brought her in at night and let her sleep in a crate in the kitchen. Now she was contentedly curled up in a pile of hay, chewing a rubber bone. The collie's owner had, in fact, actually called me to surrender her dog. Though she had been beside herself with amazed joy over the mysterious gift of a full propane tank, there had been tears in her voice, too, as she confessed she was no longer able to care for her dog.
"I feel bad," she said, "but I know it's for the best. You try to give your children everything, but when my 4-year-old sat on Santa's lap, all he wanted for Christmas was to go home and sleep in his own bed." She took a brave breath. "At least he's got that. I can only do the best I can."
A story like that made me ashamed of feeling sorry for myself, but I managed it anyway. "Besides," I said, turning to leave the barn, "I'm about to join the ranks of the unemployed. I can't take on another mouth to feed."
"Do you know, my dear," Maud said thoughtfully, glancing around the vast, dusty interior of the barn, "it would take almost nothing to convert this building into a functioning boarding kennel and training facility.
Your father's horses always did live better than most families in this county. Concrete floors, heating and plumbing already in place. The investment would be minimal for you.
You already have more people asking you to teach classes than you can accommodate in the summer. And if you had an indoor facility, you could do it year-round. You have room for 20 boarders easily.
and even at half capacity, that would be a reasonable income. I looked at her skeptically. A boarding kennel is a lot of work. But there is something to be said for owning one's own business. I suppose. I couldn't believe I was actually considering it, however briefly. And I do like teaching. You're quite good at it. I returned a half-smile to the woman who had been training me to train dogs since I was 8 years old. I learned from the best, and then I shrugged. But there's no money in dog training. Besides, my gaze slid away uncomfortably. I don't have a dog. Perhaps I should have mentioned that it had been Maud who had given me my beloved Cassidy, a product of her own championship kennel, Sundance. I suspected that, in some ways, losing Cassidy had been as hard on Maud as it had been on me, and I still couldn't mention Cassidy's name to Maud without tearing up. Before that could happen, I added, "Anyway, I've got to get going." Aunt Mart talked me into being on the family's first Christmas baskets committee, and we're meeting at the church to fill the baskets this afternoon. You'll put the word out about the collie, right?
I will. And you'll think about what I said?
Because I wasn't entirely sure whether she was referring to what she had said about the collie or about the kennel, I was careful to promise nothing except to call her later, and I hurried off to meet my aunt. There was a sheriff's department patrol car in front of the church when I pulled in, and I naturally assumed it belonged to my uncle, who had dropped Aunt Mart off for the meeting. I circled around to the basement door and parked beside the other vehicles, tucking my coat and scarf more securely around me as I got out into the cold. A moment later, I was stripping gloves, hat, scarf, and coat off as the blast of overheated air from inside the church basement hit me. A dozen or so women were gathered in a long concrete-floored room to the left, and I could hear their voices as I approached.
"Absolutely scandalous, if you ask me. A man like that, running off with a woman half his age?"
For some reason, I always felt self-conscious when I heard the words scandalous, man, and running off with a woman in a sentence together, as though that sentence might in some way be referring to my failed marriage. So I entered the room hesitantly, stuffing my gloves into my coat pocket, only to be greeted by a cheerful, "Oh, hey, Rain. We were just talking about that scamp Jess Hansen. Have you ever heard the like?" Well, it's like my daddy always used to say, you wouldn't worry so much about what other people thought of you if you realized how seldom they did. My ex-husband Buck and I were old news by now. Of course I should have realized people had found something more interesting to talk about. The room was lined with long tables, upon which were stacked piles of canned goods, packaged breads and cookies, canned hams, and straw baskets. The women had set up an assembly line, filling each basket with one item from the pile in front of them, and topping it off with a red bow at the end. There were stacks of cardboard boxes from the food bank placed strategically around the room, and Aunt Mart was unpacking them.
"Well, now, all I know is that Jess Hansen was a fine member of this community, and an absolutely perfect Santa Claus for over 60 years, asserted Aunt Mart, and paused with her arms full of jellied cranberry sauce to offer her cheek for a kiss, which I obliged. "And if he wants to spend his sunset years in Jupiter Beach with that redhead, more power to him. Hello, Rain, dear. At least we were lucky enough to find someone to replace him."
I had been a little self-involved the past few months and wasn't entirely up on all the gossip, but I gathered that Jess Hansen, who had been the town Santa for as long as I could remember, had moved on to warmer pursuits. "So who's playing Santa now?" I asked, hanging up my coat and pushing up my sleeves. Since I was probably the youngest person there, I figured my job would be the heavy lifting, so I headed for the cardboard boxes. I was just by Hansen's department store, and there was some guy in a red suit sitting in the window display with a line of children out the door.
"Some fella from up Raleigh way," answered Danella Gray, mother of three. "He just moved here last month. Retired carpenter, I think somebody told me. To tell the truth, I like him a lot better than Jess as Santa. That beard of his is real, and the kids know the difference, let me tell you. He's been really nice about taking over all of Jess's obligations, even the unpaid ones. The school parties, the church pageant, and of course he'll play Santa at the town Christmas party."
I still think that Jess Hansen had a nerve.
The women worked and gossiped with equal energy, never missing a beat as they passed the baskets down the line to be filled.
Wow, I said, settling a heavy box of canned hams on the table. This sure is a lot of stuff.
75 baskets, replied Aunt Mart sadly. And that doesn't even meet the need. It just breaks my heart, right here at Christmas time, to know all the families that are hurting. We're each going to take on delivering 10 baskets. I was wondering, Rain, if you'd mind driving me in your car, since it's so much bigger.
I said, sure, but isn't that why Uncle Roe is here? I saw his patrol car out front.
She looked surprised.
That's not Roe.
He's got a lunch meeting with the mayor, and you know those things always go on all afternoon.
Then she glanced across the table and said, wait, Sarah Lynn. First the creamed corn, then the green peas.
You've got 2 cans of peas there.
Sarah Lynn pointed out that she was out of creamed corn, and after a search through the boxes, Aunt Mart sent me upstairs to make sure that all the cartons had been brought down from the church office. That was when I met my ex-husband, coming out of the administrative wing. I should have mentioned that my ex is a deputy sheriff, and he had worked for my uncle even longer than he had been married to me. To say we now found ourselves in an awkward situation would be an understatement, and I wasn't just talking about meeting each other in the corridor of a church on a Wednesday afternoon. Buck Lawson had the kind of lazy, good looks that women found hard to resist. Rumpled curly hair, kind hazel eyes, an easy smile, and a genuine interest in folks. Unfortunately, Buck found the admiration of women equally difficult to resist, which was where all his problems began, at least as far as I was concerned. We each came to a dead stop in the hallway, about 10 feet apart, and stared at each other like a couple of deer in the headlights until I, determined to be the bigger person, cleared my throat a little and said, almost casually, hi, Buck. What are you doing here? He hesitated a moment, as though he wasn't quite sure of the answer to that, gave a little half-glance over his shoulder toward the office to orient himself, and answered, oh, we got a call. The love offering from the Christmas cantata was robbed. Can you believe that? $485. The damnedest thing is, there was only $502 in the plate. He gave a small shake of his head. I don't know what the world is coming to.
Well, times are hard, I guess, I offered awkwardly.
Sims Sporting Goods has been hit twice this month alone, he said. It's got to where they don't even leave any cash in the register anymore. Of course, Lou Sims is such an old skinflint it's hard to feel sorry for him. But stealing from a church is something else.
We stood there for another uncomfortable moment, out of small talk, and then I blurted, I just came up for corn. And he said at the same time,
Rain, I need to talk to you about something.
We both broke off expectantly, and he looked embarrassed.
Look, he said, your uncle invited me to Christmas dinner, just like always. I'm sure he wasn't thinking, but I told him no, of course. I just wanted you to know it wasn't because, well, because I was with someone else. I just didn't think it was right, that's all.
I swallowed hard. I had not yet been able to imagine what it would be like at the holiday table this year. None of my dad's corny jokes. No golden retriever hiding under the table waiting to filch pieces of turkey and homemade biscuits. No quiet, shared smiles between me and the person who was supposed to have loved me for the rest of my life. I said, yeah, okay.
I volunteered to work on Christmas. You know, give the family guys a day off.
That's good. My tone was stiff. He looked bleak.
Rain, I don't think I can stand for you to hate me.
I thrust my hands into my pockets and managed to mutter, I don't hate you. I wasn't entirely sure whether that was true. He took a step toward me, his eyes softening in a way that made me wish I had not just told him I didn't hate him.
Rain, I am so sorry, he said. I don't expect you to forgive me, but I just want you to know I understand what I've done to you, and if I could take it back, I would. You deserve so much better. I'm just so damn sorry.
The thing is, I knew he meant it. Every word. And listening to him just made me tired. I said, I'm glad you're sorry.
I know you think that's supposed to make everything better. I trusted you, and you lied to me. You promised to be there for the rest of my life, and now I'm all alone in that big house at Christmas. We said we'd take care of each other, and now I'm taking care of myself. But I'm glad you're sorry. He dropped his gaze.
I don't suppose... Do you ever see a time when we might be friends again?
I said simply. No. And I turned and walked back toward the basement. Let somebody else worry about the corn. And that was when I heard a scream. Buck had been a high school football hero, naturally, and he hadn't lost any speed over the years. He outran me to the vestibule, but not by much. That had been my aunt's voice I'd heard.
Stop, thief! Stop! She cried.
I arrived just as Buck was tackling a denim-jacketed man who was halfway out the door. Tackle might have been too strong a word. Buck's modus operandi has always been on the mild side, so it was more like he caught the guy casually by the elbow and the collar, turned him back into the room, and said,
"Whoa, dude, what's your hurry?"
Meanwhile, I rushed to Aunt Mart, who had grabbed an umbrella from the stand in the vestibule and held it like a baseball bat, her chest heaving with indignation and her eyes flashing at the perpetrator. My aunt was every bit the Southern lady, but she had been around law enforcement too long not to rise to the occasion when it counted. "Aunt Mart, are you all right?" I put my hands around the umbrella and tried to gently take it from her, but she was having none of it.
"I'm fine,"
she returned shortly, tightening her grip on the umbrella. "But it's a good thing Buck got here when he did, or that young man would not have been, I can assure you of that." With a final warning look at the suspect in custody, she turned to me.
"I came up to tell you we found the other cartons of corn, and I heard somebody creeping around up front, and I thought it might be one of the volunteers who was lost, so I peeked around the corner, and what should I see but this miscreant trying to break into the tithe box."
"I wasn't breaking in," returned the miscreant in question angrily.
The scattered bills all over the marble floor and the broken hinge on the tithe box would seem to belie his story, not to mention the wad of cash that was still clearly clutched in one hand. Aunt Mart turned on him with eyes blazing and her chest heaving with righteous indignation, raising the umbrella another couple of threatening inches.
"How dare you steal from the Lord in his own house? All that glitters is not gold, you know. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. And woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born."
By this time the pastor had arrived with his secretary, and between the three of us we were able to persuade Aunt Mart to relinquish the umbrella. She did so with a dusting of her hands and a single tug at the hem of her jacket, and if Buck's grip had failed to hold the villain, her glare certainly would have. He was a thin man in his late 30s, with a prominent Adam's apple and lank brown hair falling over his eyes. He wore muddy work boots and faded jeans that were just this side of being threadbare. His jacket wasn't nearly warm enough to keep out the kind of cold we were expecting over the next few days. He was clearly such an amateur thief, and so clearly caught dead to rights, that I couldn't help feeling a little sorry for him.
"I wasn't breaking in," the man repeated, starting to sweat. "I know this looks bad, but I can explain." "Maybe you can start by explaining this," Buck invited, nodding at the money on the floor. "And where did you get that cash in your hand there?"
"Well, it wasn't from the tithe box," said the secretary, looking both alarmed and slightly pleased with herself. "At least I don't see how it could be. I emptied it at 1 o'clock, just like I do every Wednesday, and unless we've had more drop-ins in the last half hour than we've had all week, this money didn't come from the box."
The pastor confirmed her claim, and the suspect practically sagged with relief.
"I'm trying to tell you, I wasn't taking money out. I was trying..."
His voice fell, and he looked embarrassed. I would have been embarrassed, too, if I'd had such a lame story.
"I was trying to put it back in."
My aunt and I exchanged a look. Even she, who always saw the best in everyone, wasn't buying this one. I felt so bad for the guy, I couldn't even look at him.
so I knelt down and started picking up the scattered bills. They were mostly ones, with a few fives here and there, exactly the kind of denominations you'd find in a donation box. Buck said politely,
"You want to explain all the money on the floor, Mr.? It's Jacobs. Jim Jacobs," he said miserably. "Look, I don't expect you to believe me, but there's $110 altogether, with what I dropped and what I still have."
He opened his hand and Buck took the money he offered. I added my pile to it, and Buck passed the money to the pastor.
"I found it last night in my mailbox, bound up in a rubber band with a note that said, 'From your secret Santa,'" Jacobs went on. "And when I heard on the radio this morning that the church had been robbed,"
Buck said.
"You heard it on the radio?"
Now the pastor looked embarrassed.
"Lenny Fox is the church treasurer," he explained. "Of course, we called him first thing."
Lenny Fox was also the morning announcer for our local AM station. Jim Jacobs nodded, his Adam's apple bobbing.
"The thing is, times have been a little rough for us since the plant closed, and we got the final notice on the electric bill. And my oldest boy, now I'm not saying he's no angel, but he's never been in any serious trouble with the law. But he must have heard us arguing about it, my wife and me. You know, how folks do when times are bad. Because he banged out of the house the other night saying something about how he was going to fix things. And the next thing I know, there's this money in the mailbox, which is exactly what it would take to keep the lights on. So what am I supposed to think? He never would admit it. But I'm telling you, Deputy, we're an honest, God-loving family, and no son of mine is going to stand before his maker with this on his conscience. So I came here to give the money back. Only, a dull flush crept up his collar. The slot was too small, and I was afraid if I stood here long enough to put it all in one bill at a time, somebody would come by and see me, and wonder where I got that kind of money to give to the church. So I tried to pull up the lid just enough to push the money through, but the hinge broke. And then,
his voice trailed off pitifully. We all knew what had happened next. I felt compelled to speak up. "Listen, Buck, it probably doesn't mean anything, but he might be telling the truth about the Secret Santa thing." I told him about my experience with the propane truck driver, and a look of speculative interest lit the faces of everyone in the room, except Jim Jacobs, of course, who just looked miserable. The pastor said, "Well, I for one am pleased to think there's a philanthropist in our midst, whether it's technically true or not." He offered the cash to Buck, neatly stacked and counted.
$110, just like he said. And I don't know of any law that prosecutes a man for trying to give money to the church."
Buck glanced down at the money.
"I'm guessing you don't want to press charges for the broken box." "You guess correctly."
Somewhat reluctantly, Buck released Jacob's arm.
"I'm going to want to talk to your son. Meantime,"
he inclined his head toward the cash the pastor still held,
"looks to me like that belongs to the church."
That's the way things are handled in a small town. My aunt surveyed the perpetrator, who had not yet completely grasped the fact that he was free, thoughtfully.
"Jacobs, are you the James Jacobs with two children who lives out on Blackberry Mountain?"
He answered cautiously.
"Yes, ma'am."
"Oh, for heaven's sake, you're on our list."
She turned to me and repeated, as though that explained everything,
"He's on our list."
She reached for his hand.
"Come downstairs and have a hot cup of coffee and some cookies. We're going to fix up a box for you to take home to those children."
Like I said, that's the way things are done in a small town. Over the next several days, stories began to pile up about the Secret Santa. At least a dozen of the recipients of our food baskets had also received a gift from Secret Santa, an envelope filled with cash for some. For one, it had been a new water heater after being unable to replace the broken one for 6 months. One elderly woman who lived alone in a drafty old house had found a beautifully wrapped package containing an electric blanket on her porch, along with a note that read, "From your secret Santa." More than one family with small children had discovered that wrapped gifts with their children's names on them had been left by their door overnight, and the tag on each one read, "From your secret Santa." An excited buzz of speculation and anticipation started to build throughout the town,
As everyone tried to guess the philanthropist's identity, Anne secretly hoped they might be the next object of his generosity.
It's like that billionaire in Kansas City who went around giving $100 bills to the homeless,
or that fella in L.A. who dropped cash from a helicopter,
or that guy who travels to a different city every Christmas handing out cash in the projects.
My aunt did not think it was any of those.
One person couldn't do all of this, she maintained. It simply has to be a group, like the Boy Scouts or the Knights of Columbus. I said, I wonder how he knows what everyone needs.
I shouldn't imagine it would be that difficult, observed Maud. All one would need is a glimpse at the case file from one of any number of charitable organizations. Maud, Aunt Mart, and I were on our way home from the Women's Club Christmas Gala, at which a lot of cheese puffs had been eaten and a lot of fruit punch consumed. An endless list of thank yous had been read, and a program involving the middle school chorale had been presented. I am not a member of the women's club, and their meetings are usually the kind of thing I'd fake a case of the flu to avoid attending. But my aunt had invited me as part of her Keep Rain Busy campaign, and I just didn't have the energy to refuse. Maud, who was a member of the women's club, but rarely actually attended meetings, had come along for moral support. Naturally, Secret Santa had been a subject of gossip and speculation at the meeting. Everyone had a story. No one had a clue. My favorite theory, however, was the one involving the head of the textile plant who had suddenly found Jesus, a conscience, a desperate need to redeem himself after putting so many people out of work and plunging the county into a premature economic depression. I said with a sigh, well, whoever he is, I sure wish he would pay me a visit. My aunt, who was driving, laughed lightly.
Honey, don't we all? Why, only the other day...
Suddenly she hit the brakes so hard that my seatbelt locked.
Good heavens, are those foxes?
No, said Maud, twisting in her seat to look out the window.
They're puppies.
But I had already unfastened my seatbelt and was scrambling out the back door, hurrying toward the two small gray forms that were gamboling along the side of the road and into the path of traffic. I scooped up the pups before they could make a fatal mistake, and I recall the amusement in Maud's tone as she observed, "Maybe he already has." A couple of hours later, two gorgeous blue merle Australian shepherd puppies were making themselves at home in the hay-lined stall next to the young collie. They were mirror opposites of each other. One with a patch over the left eye, the other with a patch over the right. Both perfect little females, about 12 weeks old. I can't believe people sometimes, I said, fuming. Just look at those pups. Natural bobbed tails, perfect fold on the ears. Who would just toss them out? I mean, look at them.
Gorgeous, agreed Maud.
But times are difficult for everyone. Perhaps whoever abandoned them was hoping they were setting them free to find the perfect home. She looked at me meaningfully. Oh, for heaven's sake. I gave an impatient shake of my head. I told you, I'm not ready for a dog.
When will you be ready? Asked Maud reasonably.
I frowned uncomfortably. I don't know. Maybe never. I don't believe that for a moment. Maud's gaze was steady and compassionate.
Rain, she said. You are punishing yourself for something that wasn't your fault. Cassidy lived a full, long life, and it was her time to go. Someone else chose to end your marriage. You didn't. Your father would not have wanted you to keep this place like a museum to honor him. He would want you to live in every inch of it. You need to get on with it. She was really starting to annoy me on the subject. Look, I can barely take care of myself, much less a dog, I told her. If I read my own application on a pet adoption form, I'd turn it down. Besides, you know what they say. When the time is right, the right dog will appear. A collie and two Australian shepherds have already appeared, she pointed out. What more do you want? I blinked back a surprising hotness in my eyes, and the anger in my voice was both unexpected and embarrassing. I want Cassidy back, I said tightly. I want to have Christmas dinner with my dad one more time. I want my husband to keep his marriage vows. And right now, I want to find a home for these puppies.
I turned on my heel and walked away. I advertised the dogs on the radio and in the paper. I had several calls about the Aussie puppies, but most people wanted only one, and the pups were so obviously attached to each other, not only litter mates but twins, that I hated to break up the pair unless I absolutely had to. A couple of people were interested in the collie, but when I interviewed them, I knew that she would just be going to sit atop another doghouse in another muddy 10x10 pen. Perhaps the hardest thing I had to do was to turn people down because they couldn't afford the adoption fee, which was just enough to cover the cost of shots and spay-neuter surgery, which our vet performed at his own cost. In the case of the puppies, that came to $66.50 each. For the collie, it was slightly less. On more than one occasion, I was tempted to waive the fee, but the Humane Society had a strict policy, and I had to honor it, particularly since I was the one who had written the policy. Besides, I was as unemployed as everyone else in the county, and I couldn't afford to pay the fee out of my own pocket. And then I had an excited call from a young mother who had wanted to get one of the puppies for her 10-year-old son, but who, upon learning of the fee, had hung up in disappointment before I could even add that I was looking to place the puppies together.
"It's a miracle," she exclaimed, barely pausing to remind me who she was. "An absolute Christmas miracle. I mean, I heard about that woman that got her rent paid just when she was about to be kicked out on the street. And you heard about Craig Killian's transmission going out and him with no way to get to work over in Wilford. And then the very next day, he got $485 in the mail, which is just what it was going to cost to fix his car. I know it's happening all over town, but I never expected it to happen to me, to us, to Nick. All he's been asking for all year was a puppy for Christmas. And when I told him we couldn't afford the fee, he was so disappointed that I just didn't know what we were going to do. Johnson tried to get extra shifts down at the gas station, and I started asking around to see if somebody didn't need their house cleaned for Christmas. But you know how it is this time of year. Nobody has any extra cash. Until I looked in the mailbox this morning, and what did I see but an envelope from Secret Santa with, this is the miracle part, exactly $66.50 in it.
Wow, I said, impressed. That is a miracle.
And even though Johnson says we could buy Nicky a lot of Christmas toys for that much money, what he wants is a puppy. So I knew I had to call you back. The only thing is, we were hoping to get something with a little less hair, and Nick has always wanted a dog like Snoopy. I don't guess you'd have any beagles, would you?
I told her I wasn't sure, but gave her the telephone number of our foster home coordinator, secretly a little glad that she hadn't taken one of the Aussies after all. Like I said, I hated to break them up. I was still puzzling over the whole thing. $66.50 exactly, as I drove into town to meet my uncle for our annual lunch and shopping trip to pick out Aunt Mart's Christmas present. And it wasn't just the adoption fee. What was it about the story about Craig Killian's transmission that was bothering me? By the time I reached my uncle's office in the public safety building, I thought I had it figured out. There was a fruit-studded wreath on the front door and garlands over the doorways, courtesy of the Hanover County Beautification Society. But otherwise, it was pretty much business as usual at the sheriff's department. I greeted the girl at the front desk and said hello to Wynn, Buck's partner, who was typing up a report. They told me I could find my uncle in the meeting room. I started back and then hesitated. "Is Buck around?" "He's taking some personal time," answered the receptionist, and then held up a finger as she took a call. "Sheriff's Department." "He said he was working on a Christmas present for someone special," volunteered Wynn from her computer station, and then immediately looked embarrassed. We both knew that this year, that someone special would not be me. I spoke quickly over my own discomfort, trying to sound casual. "Say, Wynn, did you work the church case with Buck? You know, the cantata robbery?" She shook her head and swiveled her chair toward me, eager to make amends. "I was on desk duty that day, trying to catch up on the paperwork. I swear, I've never seen such a Christmas for robberies and petty theft." "Why? Something I can help you with?"
I was just trying to remember how much was taken exactly. She turned to her computer and typed a few keys.
$485, she said.
Apparently, the offering plate was left unattended in the church office for about 10 minutes while the usher took pictures for the church bulletin. She scrolled down a screen.
The thief didn't get it all, though. He must have heard someone coming and skedaddled.
Any suspects?
Nah. There were almost 300 people there that night. They had Santa Claus for the kids and a big buffet supper afterwards. I hate this kind of case.
It could have been anybody. She looked up from the screen.
How come?
Nothing, really. Just an idea I had. Thanks, Wynn. Thoughtfully, I went in search of my uncle. I found him in the meeting room, as directed, standing in front of a whiteboard with his hands clasped behind his back. The board was filled with sloppy squares, pointy stars, and looped arrows, which I gradually began to understand was a diagram of some sort, and my uncle was gazing at it with studied absorption. I said, "Hi, Uncle Roe. About ready for lunch?" He gave a small shake of his head.
"I just can't see it. There's got to be a pattern, but I can't figure it out."
I moved closer to the board as he pointed.
"The Salvation Army kettle outside Hansen's department store. Hit twice. Three ladies had their wallets emptied. Not credit cards, just cash. From the cash and carry. Cash registers hit all over town, not just once, but randomly over the past month. And these guys are smart, too. They don't take everything at once, but leave a little behind so the robbery isn't noticed right away. All the churches have been hit, and the hospital fund, and the Red Cross collection boxes. And," his voice rose in indignation, "just last night the empty stocking fund, if you can believe that. They got $66.
And 50 cents, I said softly. And he turned to look at me sharply.
"Uncle Roe, I think I know who the thief is."
"So Secret Santa is actually Robin Hood," said Maud with a small shake of her head. "Whoever would have guessed?"
"Robin Hood, my eye," replied Sarah Beth Potts with a sniff. "Robin Hood took from the rich to give to the poor. I don't know what you call somebody who takes from churches and Salvation Army kettles."
"Do you mean besides a thief?"
said someone else, and we all laughed a little, though without much humor. There were 5 of us setting up the Humane Society's adoption corner for the town Christmas party, which was really just an excuse to get shoppers downtown on this last weekend before Christmas, in hopes that a little more cash would find its way into the hands of local businessmen. All the shops were gaily decorated and offering cookies and hot cider all day long, along with today-only discounts and door prizes. There were carolers and raffles, and special performances by the various choirs, as well as scheduled appearances by Santa Claus around town. Uncle Roe had a full contingent of deputies working security for the event, and though he was usually a stickler for maintaining the dignity of law enforcement, on this occasion he had bowed to the pressure of the Downtown Business Association and had issued red Santa Claus hats to all his officers. The Humane Society was always given a prime spot on the town square next to the Christmas tree, and this year we had also been able to book a photographer for a Have Your Pets Picture Taken with Santa session. In the spirit of the event, all the volunteers wore jaunty elf hats and spay or neuter your pet buttons in Christmas colors. We were the last stop for Santa photos before the big day, and we had already sold 30 tickets at $5 a pop. "Anyway," I added, "keep your eye on the collection jar. Knowing what he is isn't the same as knowing who he is. The sheriff's department has been trying to interview everyone who got a gift from Secret Santa, but so far no suspects."
"Does that surprise you?" said Callie Anders, the photographer, who was busy setting up her faux-painted foam core Christmas backdrop while the rest of us lugged heavy wire cages and X-pens across the street to the town square. When I looked at her with what may have been a skeptically raised eyebrow, she explained,
"I mean, really, the sheriff's department expects these people to give up the person who saved their Christmas? Even if they did know who it was, they wouldn't tell."
To tell the truth, I hadn't thought about that. Now I did.
"Merry Christmas, ladies."
A strong, gloved hand fell on my shoulder and on the shoulder of the woman working next to me. I twisted around to look into the twinkling blue eyes of Santa Claus. He had a strong, booming voice and an electric presence that, I had to admit, took me aback for a moment.
You know Santa has a special place in his heart for those who take care of his smallest elves, don't you?
Okay, that made me smile. I transferred the two wriggling Australian shepherds into their temporary straw-lined pen and replied, I hope that means Santa has already found a home for these puppies. When I straightened up from placing the pups in the pen, he was smiling at me kindly.
Don't worry, he said. When the time is right, the right dog will appear.
I felt a tingly sensation all over, and for a moment I couldn't think of what to say. Callie came up and touched his shoulder, pointing out the sheet-draped chair where he would be posing for photos with the pets, and I grabbed Maud's arm. Did you tell him to say that? I demanded, half-whispering. She had a black mutt on a leash in one hand and a pointer hound mix tugging at the leash on the other, and she looked mildly baffled. Tell who to say what? I whirled around to point at Santa, but he had moved off into the crowd. I muttered something unintelligible and hurried off with my head down to help unload the rest of the animals for adoption into the display. We adopted 6 animals, 4 kittens and 2 puppies, to new homes, and had a steady stream of pets and pet owners lined up to have their pictures taken with Santa Claus. The mother and son who had called me about their Christmas miracle came by to have their Beagle Mix puppies picture taken with Santa and left an extra $2 in the donation box. The Beagle would probably grow up to be a coonhound, but the young boy loved it, and in this business, that's all that matters. We collected over $200 from the photos, and everyone who stopped by would stuff another dollar or two into our plastic dog-shaped collection jar. As busy as I was, I made sure that jar was never out of my sight or the sight of one of the volunteers, and at the end of the day I counted $326 in bills and another 20 or so in change. I left the change in the jar and slipped a rubber band around the bills, handing it all over to Sarah Beth Potts, our treasurer. If you leave now, you can get this to the bank before it closes, I told her. We've only got a few more pictures with Santa, and then we're going to start packing up. She tucked the envelope into her purse and zipped it up securely. Okay, give me 5 minutes to give Santa a hand with that little dachshund. He already tried to bite one of the girls. I grimaced. Santa or the dog? Very funny. Do you need any help? No, I've got it, she called back over the sound of excited, high-pitched barking and moved to Santa's station to calm the sharp-toothed dachshund. The picture was taken without incident, and Sarah Beth reported that Santa had been a good sport about the whole thing as she hurried off to the bank. The rest of us congratulated ourselves on a successful day as we started to pack up. The crowds had begun to thin. The apple cider and hot chocolate was running low, and the setting sun painted the sky overhead a dusky orange. The temperature had started to drop, and despite their warm beds filled with shredded newspaper and the furniture pads that shielded the crates from the wind, I didn't want to keep the animals out in the cold much longer. There were only a couple of people left in line for Santa photos, and while Cassie set up her last shots, I started to break down the adoption station. I can't believe no one was interested in those cute puppies, I said, looking in dismay at my 2 Aussies. We had decided against bringing the collie to adoption day, since there was a good chance that the children of the original owner might spot her, but I'd really thought the Australian Shepherd pups would find a home today. It's not that no one was interested, Maud pointed out, but that no one qualified, at least according to your standards. I drew a breath to challenge her on that, but a voice from behind me stopped my thought.
Rain, got a minute?
I turned to see Buck coming toward me. He was wearing a fleece-lined denim jacket over his uniform and had a red Santa's hat sticking out his back pocket. In his arms he carried a medium-sized cardboard box, and on his face was an expression that was about as uncomfortable as I had ever seen. He glanced beyond me at Maud, and then back to me.
When Rose said I could find you here, I didn't know.
His gaze swept the surroundings, puppy cages, Santa and all, and grew even more uncomfortable.
This probably isn't the best time, but I go on duty in 10 minutes and, well, I brought you something.
He set the box on the ground, but before he could lift the lid, it toppled to the ground of its own accord. 2 fuzzy golden paws and a tiny golden retriever face with charcoal nose and chocolate eyes appeared over the edge of the box. I heard Maud gasp softly behind me,
and when I glanced at her, I saw that her lips were pressed tightly together and sealed by two fingers. Otherwise, she was expressionless. I may have mentioned that Maud is British and doesn't express emotions easily, but in this case, she didn't have to. I looked at the puppy, and I knew exactly what she was thinking. I had not seen anything so beautiful since the day I had first looked at Cassidy. The puppy tumbled out of the box with its jingle bell collar jingling and its red leash trailing behind it. I sank to my knees and caught the leash before the pup could scamper away into the crowd.
"Oh," I gasped. "Oh, Maud, will you look at this? Look at his head, his eyes, those perfect little ears. This pup is confirmation ready. Who breeds goldens like this around here? Buck, where did you get him?"
"Oh, never mind. I don't want to know. I'd just have to go to jail for beating up the person who abandoned this precious puppy, and that would ruin everybody's Christmas." By then, I was snuggling the pup next to my face, and his sharp little teeth were alternating between chewing on my chin and chewing on his leash. "But we're getting ready to close down here," I said, glancing around anxiously. "Why didn't you bring him in earlier?"
I heard Maud say softly, "Oh, my word. You did it. You found him."
The pup had clamped onto the pom-pom of my elf hat and dragged it off my head. Laughing, I let him have the hat and watched as he attacked it with a little puppy growl and shook it with all the ferocity of a T-Rex taking out a saber-toothed tiger. I stood up, holding onto the leash, and Buck's expression, as he watched the puppy's antics, was even odder than it had been before. Something of a mix between amusement, indulgence, embarrassment, and uncertainty. He said,
"Rain, I didn't exactly bring the pup for the adoption day. What I mean to say is..."
He fumbled in his pocket and brought out an envelope, which he handed to me.
"He has papers. And a registered name, if you're interested. It's Cassidy's Sundance Rides Again."
I just stared at him, not reacting at all. But I remember thinking, from out of nowhere, "The Cisco Kid." I looked down at the pup, who was now on his belly, shredding my hat into a pile of yarn and fuzz between his paws, and I knew that was his name. Cisco. Maud came up beside me quietly. "Buck asked for a list of the owners of all Cassidy's pups," she said. I didn't know why.
"I found one of them in Ohio," he said, "and they had one pup left from their last litter. It seemed like it was meant to be."
Okay. There was so much I could have said. In the first place, you never, ever give a puppy as a present, particularly to someone who doesn't know the puppy is coming and who hasn't asked for it. Seriously. Buck knew better. In the second place, here we were in the middle of a Humane Society adoption day with at least a half dozen puppies we couldn't find homes for, and he had brought me yet another puppy all the way from Ohio? Really? And in the third place, Cassidy's grandpup. He had gone all the way to Ohio to find Cassidy's grandpup, the Cisco Kid. The Cisco Kid had made mincemeat of my hat and had now started in on my shoelaces. Before I could do so, Maud bent down and scooped him up. "Come along, young master," she said. "Let's go have our photo taken, shall we?" And then there was just Buck and me, standing a few awkward feet apart, looking at each other. I clutched the envelope with Cisco's papers in my hands. I wanted to be mad. I wanted to be defensive. I couldn't think of a single thing to say. So Buck spoke first.
"Look, I thought about what you said. None of this is your fault. I'm the one who screwed up. You didn't do anything wrong, and you ended up alone, and it's not right. So..."
He shifted his gaze briefly, searching for words.
"I know it's not enough, but maybe it's a start. Somebody to watch over you, you know. And maybe do a better job than I did."
My heart gave a little twist in my chest. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Santa trying to maintain his cheery composure while Cisco chewed on his beard, clawed at his buttons, and burrowed into his pockets. Callie laughed out loud as she snapped photos, and Maud tried her best to try to keep the puppy still for the camera. I said, "Buck?" And I had no idea what would follow that.
That was probably a good thing, because at that moment, chaos broke loose. There was a cry and a crash, and I spun around to see that the golden puppy had somehow managed to catch in his teeth the white sheet that had covered Santa's throne and tug the chair over, bringing with it a table, a small decorated tree, and a basket of dog treats. Santa, Maud, and the photographer were scrambling to untangle the pup from the fabric, while the puppies in the nearby X-pens jumped and barked and clawed at their wire confines, trying to get to the spilled treats that Cisco was gobbling as fast as he could find them. Passing dogs sensed the excitement and pulled their owners toward the fray. I turned to help, and so did Buck, but just then someone grabbed my shoulder from behind.
"Oh, Rain!" Sarah Beth looked distraught. "Rain, I don't know what to do. I've looked everywhere.
I don't know how it happened. I had my purse with me the whole time." Suddenly she noticed Buck and the uniform under his jacket.
"Oh, officer, thank goodness. The money is gone. I got to the car and opened my purse for my keys, and the envelope wasn't there. I think,"
she looked horrified as the truth settled over her,
"I think someone picked my pocket,"
Buck said in that calm, authoritative way he has.
"Tell me exactly what happened."
I opened my mouth to help out, but just then Maud called,
"Rain, can you give us a hand here?"
I looked from the crisis in front of me to the crisis to the left of me, decided that Buck could handle this one for a few minutes by himself, and ran to help untangle Santa from a red leash, a mountain of cotton batting that had been shredded to look like snow, and a very slippery golden retriever puppy.
"We are so sorry," I gasped, finally reeling in the little pup from underneath the chair where he had located one last dog biscuit. "Wouldn't you know, on your last picture of the day. You've been so nice to do this for us. I can't tell you how much we appreciate it."
But Santa was laughing good-naturedly.
"Not a problem, young lady. My pleasure. Who could ask for a better job than this? Sitting around all day making children's dreams come true. Of course, in the case of this young fella."
His eyes actually twinkled as he looked at the puppy, who had settled into my arms and started chewing on one of my curls.
"I'd say his dreams have already come true."
He clucked the puppy under the chin with his index finger and winked at me.
"You know what they say, all that glitters is usually golden."
I quickly set the puppy on the ground, holding on tightly to the leash, and Santa shook hands all around while we gushed our gratitude again. He bent to pet Cisco, and the puppy bounded up and bumped Santa on the nose, hard enough to hurt. But Santa just laughed it off, moving away through the crowd, waving and ho-ho-hoing.
"We should have paid him something," Cassie said. "That's the best Santa we ever had."
"We can't, even if we wanted to." I saw no reason to postpone the inevitable, and my tone was glum. "The money is gone," I tried to explain amidst their gasps and questions, but it wasn't easy to do with the puppy bouncing and tugging at the end of the leash and winding himself beneath my feet. Sarah Beth was still talking to Buck and looking as though she was about to cry, and I knew we should go over and comfort her. I bent down to scoop up the puppy, who had found something on the ground and was methodically shredding it with his teeth. It was at that moment that I realized I no longer held the envelope with the puppy's registration papers in my hand.
"Oh, no,"
I cried, and bent to snatch the half-shredded envelope from the puppy's mouth.
"Oh, dear," said Maud. "I thought I saw him pull something out of Santa's pocket. Is it ruined?"
I glanced at her in confusion, for in the dim light it was difficult to be certain what I had rescued from the puppy until I actually held it in my hand. And even then, I stared at it for another moment before I was certain. The envelope did not contain AKC papers.
"Sarah Beth," I cried excitedly. "Buck, it's here. It's okay, I found it."
I finished what the puppy's sharp teeth had started, tearing open the envelope to reveal the cash inside. A few bills fluttered to the ground when I did so, and Maud dived to pick them up before the puppy could. Sarah Beth cried out loud in relief when she saw the cash.
"Oh, thank goodness. It's a miracle. I don't know what I would have done if I'd really lost that money. Where did you find it?"
"Make sure it's all there," Buck suggested. "Where'd you find it, Rain?"
"She didn't find it," Callie explained, laughing, The puppy did. As a matter of fact,
I looked up from counting the money. It's all here, I said, puzzled, turning the money over to Sarah Bath. Plus 62 more.
83, said Maud, handing her a 20 and a 1 that she had pried out of the puppy's mouth. Sarah Beth stared at the bills.
Wait a minute, she said. There are 6 20s here. We collected mostly 5s and a few 1s.
She looked up, confusion and distress marring her relief.
I don't think this is our money.
Maud's expression was grim. Plus this. She had a folded piece of paper in her hand, and she gave it to Buck. He looked at it, then at her.
Where did you find this?
She nodded to the puppy, who was busily sniffing the ground for something else to chew.
I think it fell out of the envelope with some of the bills.
The pup was about to chew it. I craned my neck to look at the paper. From your secret Santa, I read out loud. It took a moment for us to get it. I stared at Sarah Beth. You were helping Santa with the dachshund right after I gave you the envelope. I turned quickly to Maud. And you said the puppy pulled this envelope out of Santa's pocket?
Buck said.
Sounds to me like I need to have a chat with Mr. Claus.
I scanned the crowd until I spotted a familiar red hat. There he is! Buck moved quickly in the direction I pointed, and I scooped up the puppy and hurried to keep up. This was one interview I had no intention of missing. Think about it, I said, as we wound through the revelers toward the red hat. He was always in the right place at the right time. Hanson's Department Store, Sim's Sporting Goods, the Christmas Cantata. Every fundraising event and public party in the county. And who would suspect Santa Claus? Buck glanced at me, and I could tell his mind was working along the same track.
He always left a little something behind, he muttered.
Only when he didn't need it all, I pointed out. My excitement and my outrage grew as I added, And how did he know what people needed? The kids told him. He just 2 minutes ago said he spent all day making dreams come true. All he'd have to do is ask the right questions.
Hey,
Buck shouted, pressing forward, and a tall man in a red Santa hat turned. It was only Mike, one of Buck's fellow deputies. Buck swore under his breath.
What's up?
Mike asked.
We're looking for Santa Claus, I answered, gasping a little as we reached him.
Mike chuckled.
Who isn't? Cute dog,
he added. Thanks, I said, and the puppy, who was grinning happily with the excitement of the chase, licked my face. Big man, red suit?
No kidding, man, Buck said. Have you seen him? Yeah, he was here a minute ago.
Mike looked around.
There he is, headed toward Hanson's.
He pointed across the street. The Christmas lights started to come on all over town as we dashed across Main Street. The wreaths and candy canes that decorated the lampposts, the swags that were draped over the shop doors, the miniature trees in the store windows. The Christmas village in front of the florist shop sprang to multicolored life as we ran past, and I slowed my step a little for one more appreciative look. The big tree in the town square lit up in a cascade of red and blue and green, and a dozen sparkling red and white wreaths blinked on along the front of Hanson's department store. On the roof of the store, the North Pole came to life with snowmen, elves, reindeer, and dancing nutcrackers. The whole world was bathed in color, and somewhere a choir was singing Hark the Herald Angels. The puppy twisted this way and that in my arms, his excited panting hot against my cheek, trying to take in everything. There he is, I cried, and this time it was really him, just reaching the corner of the block that ended in a blind alley behind Hanson's.
Hey, Buck called. Hey, wait up a minute.
Santa turned, saw us, and lifted his hand in a wave.
Merry Christmas, he called back.
Hold on, we need to talk to you.
But Santa did not stop. In fact, he might have increased his pace a little as he turned the corner into the alley. And what was Buck supposed to do? Pull a gun on Santa Claus? With frustration tight on his face, he ran after him. Santa couldn't have been more than 15 or 20 steps ahead of him, and as I've said, Buck was fast. I was not so fast, particularly when weighed down by a bouncy puppy, and I burst into the alleyway, gasping for breath, a second or two behind Buck. The alley was
except for Buck, the puppy, and me, empty. Long ago, perhaps in the days of wagons, the 15-by-15 area had been used as a loading dock. Now it was nothing but a concrete walled space with no practical purpose that contained nothing but a few rotting wood pallets and a crushed gallon paint bucket. The reflected Christmas lights from the roof illuminated the small area as brightly as daytime. Nonetheless, Buck took out his flashlight and shone it on every square and empty inch. I lowered the puppy to the ground, easing my aching arms, bending at the waist to catch my breath. He was right here, I insisted, wheezing a little. I saw him. Buck frowned.
Me too.
His flashlight beam climbed the solid wall, at least a story and a half high.
Damned if I know how he got out of here.
Reindeer? Buck turned to me, about to make some equally sarcastic remark, and then stopped, listening. I heard it too. For a moment we just stared at each other, and then, slowly, raised our eyes to the sky, looking for the source of the sound that simply couldn't be mistaken for anything else. It was the crisp, clear sound of jingling sleigh bells. That was the last we ever heard of Santa Claus.
Oh, come on, said Melanie.
Her eyes were big behind her black-rimmed glasses and tinged with healthy skepticism.
You don't really expect me to believe that.
It's true, said Buck, and shared a wink with me over Melanie's head. I was there.
The room had begun to fill up while I talked, although we were still a few minutes away from the official opening of the doors. Maud had brought young Pepper in from the grooming room, freshly styled and shining like silk, with a red and white bow clipped behind each ear, and nails that were painted, at Melanie's insistence, bright red. My Aunt Mart arrived in a festive deck-the-halls-with-bows-of-collies Christmas sweater and Majesty the Collie on a leash. Majesty looked equally festive in a gold-trimmed red velvet ruffled collar and was still every bit as imperious as she had been the day I'd first met her, sitting atop a doghouse in a muddy lot. Buck had stopped by with a 50-pound sack of dog food that the boys from the department had donated for the animal shelter, and had stayed to repair a malfunctioning strand of lights and to tack up the sagging garland over the doorway. My twin Blue Merle Aussies, Mischief and Magic, had come in from the play yard calm enough to allow Melanie to wrestle them into Santa Claus hats, and now wandered happily around the room, each with a hat under her chin, looking for trouble to get into. Cisco had, of course, bounded from his mat the moment Buck opened the door, flinging himself into his hero's arms. Buck and I had been more or less amicably divorced for years now, but Buck was still Cisco's favorite person in the world. I sometimes thought that he knew, somewhere deep in his doggy heart, that Buck was the one who'd brought us together and changed both our lives. Now he pranced around the room like the gracious host and more or less model citizen he was, plumed tail waving, reminding everyone with his ineffable grin that it was indeed the season to be jolly.
Seriously, Melanie said. You caught him, right?
Wish I could say so, Buck admitted. The sheriff's department over in Broward did pick up a fellow with the same M.O. a few weeks later, but something happened with the evidence, and they had to let him go.
And no one was ever able to tie those crimes with the ones here, said Maud, if indeed you could call them crimes. Of course they were crimes, I said indignantly. He stole $326 from us.
But we received $409 in return, Maud pointed out. No one ever claimed the envelope Cisco found, so all the money went to the Humane Society.
The worst part, probably, was that I never found Cisco's registration papers, I told Melanie. My guess is that I dropped them in all the confusion, and the phony Santa picked up the envelope, thinking it was the one that had the money in it. I wish I could have seen his face when he opened up the envelope.
All you have to do is write to the AKC for a copy, said Melanie,
who, thanks to the Internet, knew a little bit about everything. Which I did, I assured her.
I never heard any more about the man, did you?
Aunt Mart came in with a bowl of ice cubes for the punch.
The most peculiar case I think Roe ever had. There was no sleigh in that alley, Melanie insisted determinedly. She straightened one of the bows behind Pepper's ear, which had already been dislodged a half dozen times in puppy play.
Then how did he get out? Buck queried, straight-faced.
And what about the sleigh bells? I added. Aren't you planning to be a detective when you grow up? Asked Maud. FBI, I corrected.
Well then, said Buck. This sounds to me like the kind of case a future FBI agent in training should be able to figure out.
Melanie said thoughtfully, yeah. Then more confidently, yeah, I will. Don't you worry about that.
She turned to walk away, then looked back at me.
You know, she said, I'm glad the Forest Service downsized you. If they hadn't, you never would have opened Dog Days. And if you hadn't opened Dog Days, you never would have met my dad and... She shrugged. Funny how things work out, huh?
I did not bother to point out that the way I had met her dad had been far, far more complicated than she made it sound. That was a story for another day. I agreed simply, right, funny.
But there was no sleigh in that alley, she repeated sternly.
She walked away, pondering, while the rest of us shared a grin. Aunt Mart slipped her arm through Buck's.
Buck, honey, I know you've got to get back to work, but if I could steal you and that hammer of yours for just one more minute, I really don't like the way that tree is tilting to the left.
She led him off, and I wandered, drawn by the pull of exquisite party food aromas, toward my office for a quick taste of what was cooking before everyone else arrived. The best thing about Melanie's dad, Miles, aside from the fact that he was inexplicably wild about me, was that he was a great cook, and he didn't mind who knew it. Thanks to him, this year the Dog Days Christmas party would include garlic shrimp, non-alcoholic eggnog, and some kind of incredible melty cheese wrapped in bacon on toast points for the adults, along with the cookies and punch for the children. I opened the door to my bright blue and yellow office where the food prep stations had been staged. And he turned, a spatula in one hand, wearing a Santa hat and an apron decorated with dancing elves. He deadpanned,
"Do you think this outfit is emasculating?"
The other great thing about Miles is that he makes me laugh way, way more than he makes me cry, which, all things considered, makes my relationship with him the best one I've ever had with anyone, except Cisco. I went into his arms and kissed his lips, which tasted of garlic shrimp and white wine sauce. He leaned his forehead against mine, looked deep into my eyes, and said softly,
"There was no sleigh in that alley."
Someone put on the Bow Wow Baritone's version of Jingle Bells, easily recognizable, since the lyrics are woof woof woof, and Miles and I carried out platters of hors d'oeuvres to the buffet table. The jingle bells over the door rang repeatedly as one dog after another tugged his owner excitedly inside. Terriers, hounds, toys, and mutts, all dressed in their Christmas finery, accompanied by men, women, and children of all ages. Someone gave Cisco a dog bone-shaped present wrapped in gold, with which he pranced around proudly, teasing the other dogs, until Pepper grabbed one end of it, and a tug-of-war ensued. The stuffed toy inside was ignored for the gold ribbon that came on the package, and Maud snapped pictures of the two golden retrievers playing tug-of-war with the ribbon. "All that glitters is usually golden," I said, grinning as I watched them. The jingle bells sounded again, and a yellow lab bounded in. Melanie, who was untangling Pepper's paws from the ribbon, looked up at the bells, then at me. She burst into laughter.
"I've got it," she cried. "It was Cisco's jingle bell collar that you heard. He was wearing a jingle bell collar in the picture, and when you put him down, he probably started scratching. It wasn't sleigh bells at all. It was Cisco."
Miles brought me a glass of eggnog, and I lifted it to Melanie in a salute. "Good for you. You'll be taking your detective first-class exam before you know it." She nodded smugly.
"I told you there was no sleigh in that alley."
She picked up the stuffed toy Cisco had dropped and started to toss it to him, then hesitated, frowning at me a little.
"Then how did Santa get out of the alley?"
I just smiled. Melanie tossed the toy for Cisco, still looking thoughtful. Cisco leaped to catch it, and took off at a dash, leading the charge toward the playroom. Dogs barked, children laughed, music played, lights twinkled. A mastiff stepped on my foot, and an Australian shepherd leaped onto the table and dunked a paw into the punch bowl. The Christmas tree swayed dangerously, and in the background, the sound of sleigh bells still could be heard. This has been All That Glitters, a Rain Stockton Dog Mystery. Written by Donna Ball. Narrated by Donna Postel. Copyright 2012 by Donna Ball. Production copyright 2014 by Donna Ball.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.